Mark chapter 9, we'll be looking at the transfiguration of Jesus Christ this morning. Mark 9, we're going to be looking at a glimpse of glory and a touch of reality. Mark 9, beginning in verse 2, we'll read down through verse 29, will be the passage that we'll deal with this morning. Mark 9, beginning in verse 2, the Bible says, "And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses. They were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, 'Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make 3 tents, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah.' For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, 'This is my beloved Son. Listen to him.' And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one of what they had seen, till the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And they asked him, 'Why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come?' And he said to them, 'Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him.' And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, 'What are you arguing about with them?' And someone from the crowd answered him, 'Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able. They were without strength.' And he answered them, 'O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me.' And they brought the boy to him. When the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the father, 'How long has this been happening to him?' And he said, 'From childhood, and it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us.' And Jesus said to him, 'If you can, all things are possible for one who believes.' Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, 'I believe, help my unbelief.' And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, 'You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again.' And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out. And the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, 'He's dead.' But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, 'Why could we not cast it out?' And he said to them, 'This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer.'" You know, it's always a dangerous thing to start a sermon by saying, "I don't understand a woman's mind," but I'm going to start it there anyway. But I'm going to also say, just as emphatically, that I do trust it. All right? When my wife starts talking colors, she pulls out the palette of colors, and she says, "See this brown? Which brown should we use?" I look at it, there's like 75 different browns. Something in the middle. I don't know. Brown's brown. No, it makes a difference. And she'll take out a couple different browns and she'll show me. "You see how this has more of an orangish hue? And you see how this brown has more of a gray? And how this gray softens the brown?" Yeah, I see that. But when it all comes together and it's on the wall, I was like, "You know what, that really looks good. It's like, it has more of a soft, it's like less orange and has more like of a..." Oh yeah, that's kind of what you were saying, isn't it? Or you take their cooking. I have 4 girls now at home, no boys.
And so we're experimenting with cooking. And they're putting different things, trying different tastes. I always get scared when I see this big bottle of vinegar come out. It's like, really? We're going to like dump some of that in cookies? This doesn't fit. You pull it out of the oven. Here, Dad, try one. How much are you going to pay me? And you sink into it. It's like, this is really good. And somehow, they're able to take that which doesn't look like it's going to mix, and they put it together in such a way that it works. In fact, it fits, and it fits beautifully. As we come to this text this morning, we're reminded of a picture of this event that's in the Vatican there in Rome. It's painted by Raphael, and this isn't the best light. You can't see it the greatest, but if you'll notice in this picture, you have Christ and Moses and Elijah up there on top of the mount, right here lying on the ground beneath them. You can barely see in the picture, but you have Peter and James and John. So you have a second level within the picture. And then you have this third level, and this one you can't see at all. I'm sorry. I should have tried this before I brought it out here. But you have the disciples. They're down at the base of the mountain, and here's the boy who's possessed with the demon. And some disciples are pointing up to Christ, who is the answer in all of his glory. But you have these three different levels within this one story. The Christ who is exalted, the disciples who are being blown away in the presence of his majesty, and those who are down below, confused, struggling, stumbling, yet somehow knowing that Christ is the answer to this problem, even as they can't solve it. As we look at this text this morning, I'd like us to break it down in terms of ingredients as far as Christian discipleship is concerned. Because when God mixes all of these ingredients together, it doesn't necessarily look like they would fit. But because they're God, it's God who puts them together, they fit, and they fit beautifully into what Christian discipleship actually is. You see, Christian discipleship is a beautiful balance of clarifying worship, which is where most of us would like to stay, confusing submission, which is where none of us want to be, and humbling service, where all of us are called to be. But this is what Christian discipleship is. It means getting a vision of Christ and submitting my desires, my comprehension, to walk by faith in humble service, allowing that vision to transform me so that I accomplish his purpose on earth as it is accomplished in heaven. Let's look at these very quickly this morning. I'm just going to put all three points up. We'll work through them together this morning. As we work through this passage, we're going to see three truths that balance Christian discipleship. The first we see at the very beginning with regard to the transfiguration. It's that disciples are fortified by worship, a vision or a foretaste of God's kingdom. I love that song, "Blessed Assurance, Jesus is Mine." Oh, what a foretaste of glory divine, right? When you come together, you worship, you get up off your knees, you've been praying, and God has done a work in your heart. You've just been in the presence of God. You're looking forward to that day when that fellowship will be uninterrupted. You're looking forward to that day when your mind can be focused without distraction on the beauties of Jesus Christ, the glories of the Father, the power, the working of the Spirit in your heart and life. And that's what we have when we come to the Transfiguration. We see that in this vision of God's kingdom, a vision of the future glory of Christ, a vision of the glory of Christ that he had before he ever came, and yet now as one who bears flesh, he has it in a unique way in the future forever. So as we look at this transfiguration, we see that this is just a foretaste of the glory of God's kingdom. And in God's kingdom, what's going to make it glorious is the fact that there's going to be a focus on the glory of Jesus Christ. As we come to verse 2, it says, after 6 days, probably a parallel to the 6 days that Moses went up onto the mount. Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John and led them up the high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. As Jesus Christ is walking in the flesh, we have to remember there was nothing special about him as far as to look at. Isaiah says that he had no beauty that we should desire him. He looked like any other guy named Joshua walking around Bethlehem, Nazareth, Jerusalem, Sea of Galilee, Capernaum, Bethsaida. He was just a guy. But at this moment, he's more than just a guy. Where this happens, we saw last week, they were up in Caesarea Philippi, up in the very far north of the Palestinian countryside. They were a little bit of 25 miles above the Sea of Galilee, right up by the base of Mount Hebron, right? Is that where it's at? Why am I forgetting the mountain? Hermon, thank you. Wow, all of a sudden, I have a senior moment and I'm only 44 years old. They're up by Mount Hermon. It's a snow-capped mountain. It's 9,000 feet high. And he's been up there. They have the confession of Peter, who says, "You are the Christ." And Jesus says, "You're right, but that doesn't look like anything what you're thinking it's going to look like, because the Son of Man must suffer. That's what this Christ has come to do before he becomes what you expect him to be, the Christ." And after 6 days, after Jesus tries to lay this out for them, and he lays out for them, because this is the path of the Christ, suffering, then this must be the path of the disciple, suffering. He brings them up on the mount, a high mountain. Tradition has it that it might be Mount Tabor, which is farther south, which is only some 1,000 feet high. It can't have been that, because there was a garrison on top of that mountain. It says they are alone. They couldn't have been alone there. It has to be up in this region, up in Caesarea Philippi. Jesus brings them there, and you put the different accounts together. He brings them up there at night. They're tired. They're sleeping. When they come down the mountain, it is the next day that they're coming down the mountain. So this takes place at night. And there's a lot of different parallels as far as putting it together, how this works with where God revealed himself in the Old Testament as well. But the thing we want to focus on right now, that as they're getting a glimpse of this future glory of God's kingdom, at the centerpiece of this glory is the person of Jesus Christ. And Jesus, who'd been an ordinary Joe like anybody else, walking around, you wouldn't distinguish him from anybody. All of a sudden it says he was changed. And the Greek word is he's metamorphosized. He's gone through the metamorphosis. You think of the word metamorphosis, you might think back to science class, the caterpillar that crawls up, curls up in a cocoon, and all of a sudden it changes from an ugly little green sluggy kind of thing to something that has wings and beautiful colors, and it flies, it has freedom, it no longer lives on the ground. It's changed from the inside out. Wiersbe says the word has the opposite meaning of the word masquerade, which means to try to induce a change from the outside in. What happens to Jesus at this moment, it says he was changed, he was transfigured before him. His clothes became radiant, intensely white, like nobody on earth could bleach them. This is, he becomes so brilliant, his clothes become so brilliant, that he becomes transcendently white. He becomes the essence of whiteness. Nothing on earth can accomplish what is accomplished in him. Both Matthew and Luke both reference the fact that his face also was like sunlight in appearance. Again, probably a parallel to the glory of Moses being on the mount in the presence of God. But here's the thing. The beauty, the resplendency of Jesus in his clothing, the brightness of the shining of his face, were not something that he was reflecting. Like Moses, when he came into the presence of God, he reflected that afterglow of God after God covered him with his hand. What's happening is Jesus is emanating this brilliance. He's emanating this glory. As the Son of God, as the person of God in flesh. One of the things that we have to keep in mind as we're disciples of Jesus is where this story is going. And this is why Jesus gives it to him. He says, guys, you will go through suffering, but after suffering, there's glory. But let's not reverse the two. It's not glory first, apart from suffering. But the only way that you can go through the suffering that God calls you to go through as a disciple, you must get a glimpse of this glory of Jesus Christ. Turn, if you would, to Revelation chapter 1. Just to help us understand and to get in our mind's eye what this glory of Jesus is like. It's nothing like Raphael's picture there in the Vatican. It's much more like what Revelation 1 gives us as John is secluded on the Isle of Patmos. We see down in verse 10, he says that I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, and so on. Verse 12, so I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white like white wool, like snow. He's trying to pile up metaphors for us. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze refined in a furnace. His voice was like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. You get a picture of what's happening here on the mount? All of a sudden, Jesus, who has no beauty that we should desire him, he's transformed, he's transfigured. And rather than simply reflecting the brilliance of God, he emanates the brilliance of God, as the God-man. It's a glory that Revelation chapter 21 says is going to light up the New Jerusalem. There's no sun there. Why? Because Jesus Christ is the sun who will light the entire spectrum of that city. What a glorious, literally, a glorious presence to be in. God's kingdom focuses on the glory of Jesus Christ, and God's kingdom focuses on fellowship with Jesus Christ. There, as he's transfigured before them, we see there in verse 4, there appeared to him Elijah with Moses. And they were doing what? They were talking with Jesus. And we know from other passages what they were talking about. They were talking about the exodus that he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. Here's a couple things that we want to note. As Elijah and Moses are talking with Jesus, that this God who's building a kingdom, who's drawing people into his kingdom, is the God of the living. He's not the God of the dead. Moses died. Elijah didn't. He was raptured, if you will. He was brought up. He was snatched away into glory. We have these two Old Testament saints that represent everybody. Everybody who's died. Everybody like Enoch and Elijah who've been snatched away. And then we have also New Testament saints. Peter, James, John. Up here on the mount, the focal point is Jesus. And they're talking with Jesus. They're conversing with Jesus. They're finding out more about the program, the plans, the work of Jesus Christ. Now, the focus in Mark's gospel in particular is focusing on the disciples going through this experience alongside of Jesus, with Jesus. In Matthew and Luke, the story is more about what happens to Jesus. But in Matthew or Mark's gospel, what happens to the disciples seems to be fronted even more. And it happens to them because of this experience. They've seen the Christ in his glory. And it affects them as they come back down off the mount. One of the important things to see is that when this event is over, Moses and Elijah disappear. But Jesus remains to walk the road to Jerusalem. Jesus at that point could have gone back up to heaven. This could have been the ascension, had he wanted it to be. But that's not his purpose. He had just told the guys, I am Christ, but I'm about to suffer. This doesn't look like anything that you think it will look like. But let me give you a glimpse of my glory. And he's changed. He's powerful. He emanates the glory of God. And all of a sudden, the cloud comes over, the voice speaks, and they're terrified. And when the cloud moves away, there's just Jesus. It's just Jesus in his unresplendent glory. He's just himself again. And he's going to walk with them to the way of the cross. We see in God's kingdom that Jesus in his glory is the focal point. Fellowship with Jesus is the focal point. Also, the work of Jesus is the focal point. They're talking with him about what he's about to accomplish, this exodus, tying it right back to the Old Testament. As for Israel, the exodus was what defined their redemption and their identity as the people of God. The exodus was when God brought them on an exit out of slavery, out of bondage, into freedom en route to the promised land, that place of blessing and the presence of God. Even so, for the church, the cross is what defines for us our exodus, our redemption, our identity as the people of God, being brought out of bondage, being brought out of sorrow, being brought into freedom, being brought into that place of blessing in the presence of God. Psalm chapter 105 focuses on the fact that we as the people of God were brought out from that land of bondage. Revelation chapter 5 focuses as all of the angels are around the throne, as all of the nations are around the throne. It focuses on the fact that these people are here because of the work of the Lamb who died and rose again and ransomed a people for his glory. In God's economy, in God's coming kingdom, the glory of Jesus Christ is going to be manifest. It's not going to be hidden. It's going to be revealed. It's going to be the focal point. Conversing, fellowship with Jesus is going to be the engine. Worship is going to drive this kingdom experience. The work of Christ in redeeming his people is going to be the underlying praise of his glory within this kingdom. And we see that in God's kingdom, there will be a focus on the priority of Jesus. The cloud comes over, and the Father says, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. Listen to him." Well, it's kind of the same construct that we have back in Deuteronomy 18, where Moses was told, "There will be another prophet who will come after you. And I want you to tell the people they must listen to him." He's speaking of Jesus Christ at the time, way back in Deuteronomy chapter 18. This is the one to whom they're to listen. But what in particular are they supposed to listen to? Back at the end of chapter 8. "You are the Christ." You're right, but it doesn't look like anything that you're anticipating. It looks like suffering. And if it looks like suffering for me, it looks like suffering for you. The Father says, "This is my beloved Son. I love him. Now listen to him. You need to be instructed in my ways. You need to be instructed in his ways." The priority of Christ. Christ is the culmination of God's revelation. Go back to Hebrews chapter 1. We've gone through the book of Hebrews a few years ago. These first verses at the beginning of the book set it up, and they set up Jesus as the hero of the story, the hero that he is. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1, "Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke." God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. Verse 2, "But in these last days, he has spoken unto us by a son." His son, a son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. And this son is the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. Jesus Christ is the culmination of all revelation. Here on this mount, we have Moses. We have Elijah, both men who climbed a mountain, Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, the exact same mountain, and they heard the voice of God. Moses, it makes a point in Exodus 24. He says, he went up into the thick darkness where God was. He entered the cloud. It talks about the Shekinah, the glory that comes down and leads the people from that mount and then comes down in chapter 40 and resides there at the tabernacle in the midst of the camp. A high mountain, a cloud, a voice. Remember Exodus chapter 18, Exodus chapter 20, where God is speaking the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel. And the people hear this voice and they're so overwhelmed. They say, Moses, Moses, we hear. But if we hear any more, he's going to kill us. You go up and talk to him. This voice is overwhelming. It's a revelation of this God. In fact, Deuteronomy says, you are a people who've heard God speak. That's what separates you from all people on earth. You have a God who speaks to you. Christ is the culmination of God's revelation because Christ is the culmination of God's plan. Way back in the garden, we remember that God set up a man, set up a woman, and he told them to be fruitful and multiply. Then he told them to what? To have, exercise dominion over the world that he created, right? Psalm chapter 8, you have put all things under his feet, all creation. For a little time you've made him lower than the angels, but you've put all creation under his feet. We see in 1 Corinthians 15 that at the end of the story, Jesus Christ is going to come back to earth and he is going to conquer all things. And when all things are conquered, when all things are put under his feet, he will turn it over as the kingdom to the Father. We see in Philippians chapter 3 that God has given him a name that is above every name so that at the name of Jesus, what? Every knee will bow. Things in heaven and things on earth and things under the earth. And that every tongue should confess Jesus as Lord to the glory of God the Father. From the very beginning, God has designed that his creation will be ruled by a man. Not Adam, but his son, Jesus Christ. That was his plan. In fact, he says that's his plan in Ephesians chapter 1, where he says that he's made known to us the mystery of his will according to his purpose, the plan that he set forth in Jesus Christ to unite all things, things in heaven and things on earth. Jesus will not only rule creation, he will unite creation. And we see in Ephesians chapter 2, that he's already begun that in taking down the dividing wall between the Jewish people of God and the Gentile people of God. He said, through Christ, all of us have access in him. He's begun the uniting process. We see what this looks like in Isaiah chapter 11, where the lion will lay down with the lamb, the bear, the goat, the ox, and all of these different things are coming together. And they're united in peace under the rule of Jesus Christ. He says, because of Jesus, they will no longer hurt in all my holy hill. They'll be there to feed each other rather than to feed themselves on each other. We saw just a moment ago in Hebrews chapter 1 that God's plan was always for a man to inherit creation. I don't know if you saw it, but back in Hebrews chapter 1 verse 2, there's a phrase that points this out very specifically. It says not only that Jesus was the culmination of God's revelation, but in verse 2 it says, in these last days he's spoken to us by a son whom he's appointed the heir of all things. Jesus is the culmination of God's plan as a man to rule creation, a man to unite creation, a man to inherit creation. We see all of this end of the story glory in this transfiguration. But we see also that the disciples then are forced to submit to Christ's purpose and his ways. As they're up there on the mount, verse 5, Peter says to Jesus, Rabbi, it's good that we're here. let's make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. What's verse 6 say? Because he didn't know what to say. I love that. The others don't record it that way. Mark does. His informant was Peter. And Peter says, go ahead and put that in there. Makes me look stupid, but that's what it was. I didn't know what to say. I love how, I think it's Hughes, Keller. Nope, it was Hughes. He says, if there is ever a time for silence, this was it. But enter Peter, a man who always had something to say when there was nothing to be said. He didn't know what to say, but he's got to say it. But as Peter makes this observation, hey, let's build some tents, we see that there is in the heart of a true disciple of Jesus a desire to linger on the mountain. When you spend time in worship, you find your breath restored. You find your burdens lifted. You find your vision clarified. You find that strength. You find that joy. You find that peace. You find that purpose. Don't you want to stay there? I just want to build a tent here. Forget a tent. Let me build a house. I want to make this permanent. It's not a bad thing for a true disciple of Jesus to want to be there in the midst of God's glory. But just like Peter's early confession, you are the Christ. You're the end time ruler of God's kingdom. Jesus says, you're right. But it won't look like that right away. Here Peter says, let's stay here. This is that kingdom. Come in power. And Jesus says, that's not possible, Peter. I've shown you this not to keep you here, but to give you the strength that you need to go back to living life as it needs to be lived this week. Is there ever a time that you wish every day was Sunday? Man, I just wish I didn't have to go back to work tomorrow. I wish there was no Mondays. Amen? I wish there was no Mondays, okay? But the purpose of Sunday is Monday. That's the whole purpose. You don't live your life on a week of Sundays. You live your life Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, with kids, with animals, with kids who are animals, with coworkers who are animals. You work there. That's where you live. Peter wants to build a tent, a tabernacle here on the mountain. But it doesn't go far enough. And we think of this as a stupid thing, but actually this is really a profound insight by Peter. Because Zechariah chapter 14, verse 16 says that the Feast of Booths, where they build these tabernacles, these tents, is going to be the celebration at the end of all time. It will be a commemoration of their wanderings and God's presence with them up to this point. The Feast of Booths has an eschatological feel to it in the book of Zechariah. And for Peter to make this connection is really a profound discipleship moment. But again, just like the confession of the Christ, it doesn't quite go far enough. There's a desire to linger on the mountain, and there's a danger of misappropriating this revelation. Who does he want to build tents for? For Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. As though they were all what? As though they were all equals. Well, you've got the two greatest characters, heroes in the Old Testament. Moses, Elijah. They are fantastic. These are men who've been on the mount with God. These are men who've heard his voice. These are men who've spoken his word. These are men who've changed the course of the people of God in history, in time and space. But these are men who only pointed to Jesus. Jesus is why they did what they did. They were always pointing to him. And when the story's over, there's no Moses, there's no Elijah, there's only Jesus. Jesus remains There's a sense of personal inadequacy. We see Peter speaking. He doesn't know what to say. And then we see at the end of verse 6, because they were what? Thrilled, right? Well, yeah, terrified. They were terrified. Their knees were knocking. Their teeth were chattering. They didn't know what to think of this. It's exactly what Revelation chapter 1, verse 17 says. We didn't read it this morning. But when John sees the glory of this Christ, the splendor of God in the flesh, he says, I fell down at his feet as though what? Dead. It's like Isaiah. I'm a dead man. My eyes have seen the King. He's terrified. And Matthew has the beautiful words as soon as the cloud departs. He says, get up, guys. You don't need to fear. Don't be afraid. It's me. It's me. But as they're coming down this mount, there's an urgent need to know more. They've just seen something, and it changes everything. They know that. But how does it change anything? Well, it changes things because they've been told to listen to him. They've been told to put themselves under his program, his purposes, his ways. Jesus says, guys, I don't want you to tell anybody about this until I've risen from the dead. Okay, guys, we're not going to say anything. We don't even know what we're talking about, but what does this rising from the dead thing mean? And there's no category for them to put it in other than the Old Testament has this general resurrection thing that was understood. Job said, even though my flesh decays, even though my body decays, yet in my flesh I shall see God. So this body decays, one day I will in my flesh see God. How's that work? Not explained. Daniel chapter 12 verse 2 speaks of many who are lying in the dust shall be resurrected and made glorious like the stars. There's this understanding in the Old Testament that at the very end of the story, there is this resurrection. But Jesus is speaking about his resurrection, and then they can talk about it. But won't it be too late? Everybody's going to be, how does this fit? This is a real confusion for them. This isn't just one of those moments where, oh, those stupid disciples, they should have known better. There was no way they could have known better. Jesus is at the very brink. He's at the very cusp. He's at the very, very edge of beginning to open their eyes at what this even means. He doesn't explain it all to them, but he asks them to submit to it. Guys, you don't understand it yet, but this is the way it is. They're starting to put pieces together. Now, wait a minute. You've talked about this suffering thing. But doesn't the Bible say that Elijah must come first, and then comes the day of the Lord? Go back in Malachi chapter 4. Malachi chapter 4. There is no Malachi 6. Malachi chapter 4. The only place that Moses and Elijah are brought together in the Old Testament is Malachi chapter 4, verse 4. This is the very end of the Old Testament. Remember the law of my servant Moses, the statutes and rules that I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel. And behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes, and he will turn the hearts of fathers to the children, hearts of the children to the fathers, lest I come and strike the land with harem, the ban. Wait a minute, Jesus? Moses and Elijah. The end of the prophets. Isn't this like, aren't we on the edge of, maybe you don't have to? Jesus says, guys, I know you don't understand it. But this is the way it must be. And then he speaks. He says, guys, Elijah did come. And they did to him whatever they wished to do. And we're told in Matthew chapter 17, they understand he was speaking of John. But Jesus, doesn't Elijah prepare the way? How does Elijah prepare the way if John dies? Jesus says, now you're starting to get it. That's exactly how he prepares the way. If Elijah dies, then the Messiah has to die. And guys, if the way of the Messiah is death, then the way of discipleship is death and suffering before glory. They come down off the mount. They're confused. But they have to submit to his purpose, his ways. They don't understand it. It's confusing. And yet they put themselves under it. They're coming down the mount. And now they've moved out of the glory, out of the victory circle. And they come back. They join the other nine disciples. And there's failure. They come back. And we see that the disciples are being forged in the exercise of faith in his service. But they're not really exercising faith, and that's the whole point of this passage. They're asked to cast the demon out of a young boy. They've not succeeded, and so there's scribes who are there arguing with the disciples. Jesus comes on the scene, and everybody's excited. Usually the excitement comes after the miracle. This time it comes before, because Jesus shows up, and they're anticipating a miracle. He talks to the scribes and says, guys, you've been antagonistic to me. We've argued before. What are you arguing about with my disciples? And before anyone has time to answer, the man with the boy comes up. He says, sir, it's my son. I brought him to your disciples just hoping that they could heal him. Now, why is that not a dumb idea? Remember Jesus? Jesus commissioned them for that, right? You're going to go out and preach. You're going to heal. You're going to cast out demons. And they did. They did. And as he brings this boy to them, they can't. And they try, and they can't, and they try, and they don't. They ask him later, why couldn't we do it? Jesus says, guys, did you ever try praying? Did you really think that this power is resident in you? That you are the ontological source of glory and power in ministry? Did you think really you could do this by yourself? Pastor, did you really think you could do this by yourself? Husband, did you really think you could do this by yourself? Mom, did you really think you could do this by yourself? But aren't we just like the disciples? I'm going to try harder, but I forget to pray. And when they don't include Christ in Christ's work, what happens? They fail. Is that a surprise? It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. God gives them something that's too big for them, and they fail. But here's the point. Humbling service sometimes requires failure. Can I say this to you, friend? That we tend to define ourselves by our failures, but God doesn't. We tend to define others by their failures, but God doesn't. In fact, the failure of the disciples at this moment is a key teaching moment for them. They must understand. You've heard it said, God will never give you anything that's too big for you to handle, right? Wrong. Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, we despaired even of life. It was too big for us to handle. It was too big. It was too much. And here God lets them fail as they keep trying in their own strength to do his work, but they can't. Why? Because they didn't connect him to his work. They needed to fail. But God didn't view them as failures. Jesus, there's some question here. Is Jesus addressing the disciples or is Jesus addressing the scribes? Oh, you generation of faithlessness. Unbelieving, faithless generation, verse 19. Every other time Jesus uses this, he's not talking to the disciples. He's probably not talking to the disciples at this point. But he does use this moment to remind them, guys, you need faith. And that's the whole point. Sometimes we need to fail in our service for God because always we need faith in our service for God. That's why at the very center of this whole story is not really the disciples. It's a father. And as this father brings his boy to Jesus, Jesus asks him, so what's the problem? And he's not asking for a case history. What he's asking for is this father to put into words, how big is the problem? And he says, it's so big, it's too much for me to handle. I can't take it anymore. I can't do it, Jesus. If you can, and Jesus picks up on those words, if I can, if you can, no. The question isn't with me. If you have faith, all things are possible. And the man submits, and he says, Jesus, I have faith, but it's very, 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 very small. Help my unbelief, because I don't have enough. I can't do this on my own. And Jesus takes that mustard seed of faith, and he says, all right, let me give you your son. And Jesus speaks to the demon, and the boy falls down on the ground. He writhes, he foams, he screams, and it's done. And he's laying there. And what's the boy's dad thinking? I don't know if he can even articulate it, but everybody else does. The kid's dead. What are you thinking if you're that dad? Jesus, looks like you took care of the problem. That wasn't quite what I was thinking. As Jesus touches it, it looks worse before it looks better, right? Then he reaches down, he takes him by the hand, lifts him up, and gives him to the Father. The Father doesn't go berserk. He just waits until Jesus is done. And that faith is rewarded. My friend, as we work through discipleship, all of us would love to be in that first category, right? We'd love to be on top of that mount. We love that worship experience, that foretaste of God's kingdom. We need worship. We need this time where we come together and we focus on Jesus Christ, where we focus on the ways of God by examining the works of God and understanding the character of God. We need this for our vision. It clarifies our worship. God never leaves us there. He always calls us to submit to the confusion that looks like real life. You don't understand what God's bringing you through right now. You don't have to. All you have to understand is that His ways are perfect and suffering precedes glory. But glory is coming. And then you have to go about doing what He's called you to do. Which means you have to humble yourself. And if you are unwilling to humble yourself and engage Him in the process of doing something that's too hard for you to handle, then you will be humiliated until you are humbled. God as your Father isn't trying to humiliate you in order to embarrass you, in order to shame you. He's humiliating you in order to humble you, to bring you to the end of yourself and make you like this Father, confessing your need of Him. And Jesus uses this beautiful teaching moment for His disciples and said, guys, what made you think you could do this without me? You need me to do my work. So as we see these three different levels in this painting, as we see these three different levels in this story, we see that the Christian discipleship is a beautiful balance that requires exactly what we're doing this morning, a worship that clarifies our vision. But it also requires Monday morning, where we submit to what we find absolutely confusing, and we're humbled by what we find to be absolutely difficult. But it's that vision that carries us through. Let's pray.